WNST, Towson, Baltimore. Baltimore Positive. We're positively into the 4th of July week. If you're watching out on the Zoomcast, YouTubecast, you'll see I'm wearing my Straight Outta Dundalk shirt. I am very proud of the Heritage Fair. We're going to be doing Heritage Fair activities this week. All of it courtesy of our friends at Wise Markets, Wise Conversations, local people, taking care of local people. We got a lot of Wise Markets in Dundalk. We got three or four that I can think of right now over on that side of town. We'll be over there celebrating this weekend with the music on Sunday night at Crack the Sky. And come on out, celebrate 100.7, have a beer in the beer garden, do the whole thing. We're going to be at Fadley's on Thursday doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery. I'll be giving away these instant lottery scratch-offs. Not as lucky a batch at Spirits West, but if anybody won $100 over there, they didn't tell me. But we did have some winners up at the local in Falston, as well as at McFall's Oyster and Reel. It's been a really fun spring. We got a summer schedule ahead to do this with our friends at Winder Nation, 866-90-NATION. I have the wacky floppy hat. I'll have that on my head at Fadley's on Thursday morning as we get ready for the 4th of July. Look, my last name's Aparicio. It's always baseball season around here, despite the fact that I'm wearing my Straight Outta Dundalk shirt. I made a lot of Dundalk baseball, too, Bilecki and some others. But this guy here joined me earlier. He's got a great name because, like, John Miller means, like, a lot to Baltimore people, and the loss of John Miller was probably the original sin in the garden of Peter and Lou and John back in the day. But this John Miller has an H in his name. He is up at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he is an author and a real journalist, kind of like I used to be before they threw me out. I don't know what happens when the establishment throws you out and you're a journalist. Probably makes you a real journalist. John Miller joins us now from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He is doing a book on Earl Weaver. We had a beautiful conversation. Man, it feels like about 9 months ago. It was a long time ago. It was in football season, actually, as I remember it, about you doing research on Earl and you finding me through me in some sort of weird way. I did the last interview with Earl Weaver. And I told that story last time. It happened in my old home at the Royal Sonesta at Harbor Court. And Earl's been gone now. I remember I was on a bus to Foxborough for a championship game. So I guess it was a couple weeks before the Super Bowl. So I guess Earl's been gone almost 10 years, a little more 10 years right now. 10 years. Yeah. And you have decided to go back and in the era of analytics, in the era of all of these changes in baseball that began with Earl's note cards in 1968, go back and do something that I haven't read. I haven't really read a legitimate biopic or inside the mind of Earl. I did my best to get inside his mind. You found me, and I'm glad you're a guest on my show. How's the book going, dude? What's going on?
Yeah, well, a lot, actually, because, you know, when I called you is because I was touched by those interviews, because I hadn't found many interviews where he was that thoughtful and profound. And I guess it was because he was about to die and leave us. And I think he was a bit more honest. And I think you brought that out of him. So I credit you for that. Well, at that point, I had not yet sold the book. So the way that books work for nonfiction books is you write a proposal that's like a sample chapter and a synopsis and a marketing plan. And
you teach me all of this for when they throw me out of radio after 30 years.
I quit the Wall Street Journal, so I know all about leaving establishment media and trying to do your own thing.
I have never been. Do I look establishment? Seriously, look at me. Anyway.
You take that proposal to agents. Basically, agents are the gatekeepers. You find an agent who digs your stuff. If you find one, they can sell it pretty quick because publishing companies trust them. But I failed 24 times to find with 24 different agents who rejected me or ignored me. What was interesting, Nestor, is that the version of the book that was like, I'm going to tell you why Earl Weaver was so great in the 70s and why the Orioles were so great, which they were, that was not selling because I think people felt like they had read that story before. What did sell was here's a story of a guy who did not make the major leagues, even though he got very close. He failed for 20 years in the minors. He was a late bloomer. And then finally, after 20 years, he made it and became the most successful manager and the most innovative manager of his day. And that's why he's in the book Moneyball. That's why I thought it was a good idea to go back and revisit and explain who this guy was and just find out some new stuff. What are the Earl Weaver stories we haven't heard? All the stories are so cliche. It's like pitching defense, three-run homers.
Yeah, and ripping up the rule books and pissing on the umpires. players. And I mean, there had to be some genius in Earl through all of that.
Yeah.
And,
so what's
and
the story
I spent
we don't
a little
know?
Bit of time around him as a young guy, and was very intimidating. He was always intimidating to say, for being a small man. I mean, first off, he was like a father figure to a kid who was 5 years old in 1973, and watching him and the way he behaved made it okay to act like that in Eastwood Little League in 1979. My dad was a bit of a hothead as well. So like the Earl Weaver hothead on the field, man, I was out there the night the Howler thing happened where Eddie Murray's laughing in his glove. Flanagan and I, before we lost Mike, Mike and I had a hell of a laugh because Mike was the pitcher that night moving off the mound. And my wife and I, when we get to have a really bad day, we'll YouTube the Earl Weaver Howler exchange about, you know, effing up World Series and like all of that, right?
You're here for one reason.
Right, to F us.
So,
right.
So I interviewed the production crew. I have a whole chapter on that argument and how that happened. It was a hot mic. They were doing a story about umpires. So Haler had a hot mic and he forgot to take it off. And so that was in the first inning. Flanagan hit the first batter, and then three pitches into the game, tries to pick him off. And that's when the balk is called. That brings out Earl. Orioles PR is freaking out. It was John Blake, who now does PR for the Rangers. I talked to
John's
him.
John's a great guy. Oh,
yeah,
my.
Yeah, he was doing Orioles PR, and he tried to physically fight the tape away from a guy named Cheese, who is the sound man, who I have not been able to find, but that's the two other production guys told me that. So Cheese is trying to keep this tape, and he's like, no, John, you ain't getting this effing tape. And they're fighting over this tape. They take it back to the studio. It goes viral 80s style, like bootleg VHS tapes, becomes like a smash hit of the underground, you know, baseball media.
The Alice in the Tomato Patch audio hit me very early on in my career in 1991.
Yep.
Always available on cassette tape. I can burn it down for you.
And that was Earl's idea because the guy was really funny. And that's the thing. Like, you can say what you want about
Tom Maher. It was Tom. T-Bone's listening right now. Brandon, their dad. I mean, Tom Maher was on CBS.
Yeah, but Earl was up for it because he was hilarious. And he was just a funny, funny, smart guy that sports writers loved. And that's why it's going to be fun to spend 200 pages with him, I hope.
Look, I almost feel like I'm having a beer with you at this point because that's where we are. It is some Rofo coffee in my coal roofing mug, as the coal roofing people call me about my most recent flood. I would just say this. I talked to you on the record, off the record. We did this on the air. We did it off the air, trying to find every Billy Hunter, trying to find everyone who's alive who may have Ken Singleton. But I'm thinking of the people that are still very vibrant that maybe have never been at. I mean, look, Palmer's done every cocktail conversation, every rubber chicken dinner. He was 5 feet. I was 7 feet. Together, we were 11 feet. We made bobblehead. I mean, and all of that freaking frack thing with Palmer. But I don't know that anybody's really ever sat down with Jim Palmer and gotten real serious, not about what a character Earl was or whatever, but his mind. And even with Palmer disagreeing with him or whatever, their shtick. But, I mean, they were together for 20 years, and they both went to the Hall of Fame. And I would think the amount of stories – I mean, Phil Jackman is struggling, and Phil's like a father to me, like an uncle. Mm-hmm. Love Phil. Phil would have a million stories for you and gave me a bunch of stories. But I'm thinking of every Richard Justice and Tim Kirchin and Ken Rosenthal. Those guys were all around the irascible end of Earl after Earl didn't win. Had to broadcast Joe Altobelli winning with his team. I've watched that tape many times with Howard Gosell ribbing him and Reggie Jackson in the locker room, like all of that. But then Earl came back and they stunk and Earl couldn't get out of his way. And then Earl went to the Hall of Fame and I guess mellowed a little bit. But man, there are got to be a lot of people that have really sat and talked baseball with Earl, not shtick with Earl, baseball.
The whole project started because I wrote Earl's obituary for the Wall Street Journal, and Tom Boswell, who is my childhood hero, sent me an email saying this was really nice. Earl would have loved this obituary. So I thought, well, maybe there's more I can do about this guy that has not been done yet. So I've sat down with Singleton, Dempsey. I've talked to Tippi Martinez. I've emailed with Palmer. We haven't sat down yet, but
neither have I. I've been trying to get Jim for 31 years now. Anybody sees Jim, let him know that I'd like to sit and talk to him.
But
by the way, Jim Palmer is the greatest Baltimore athlete there ever was, may probably there ever will be. No offense to Ray Lewis or Cal Ripken or Brooks or
He's
like
got
pick anybody
the three
you want.
rings. Yeah, I agree.
No, he's just don't look at his stats. There's a different level of when he's in the boot. We take him for granted, Palmer. We really do.
I agree. Very talented in broadcasting and pitching, incredible. But that's the thing. Earl Weaver gets reduced to cliches, man. And like, he was a human being. He used to be a little boy, you know, growing up in St. Louis with the dream of being a Major League Baseball player. He made one big league spring training camp in 1952, and he was cut on the last week by his own manager, who made himself the backup second baseman. And that Earl Weaver was 21. He was almost going to make the major leagues, and that crushed him. And that's when he started getting really depressed, started drinking too much. And it took him 20 years to get back to the majors. So that's kind of the human story.
52 to 68, right?
16 years. Yeah, sure. Yep.
Wow.
It took him
and
16
what
years.
What was his pathway in a biopic sort of way? Because I know I talked to him about why he became a man. I don't remember the conversation. Yeah. Honest, John, you'll find this hard to believe. I make the pizza and I serve it. And I rarely go back and eat it again. You know what I mean? Like, and because I'm always making it, I don't even know what Earl said to me that day. I should throw it into my OtterBox and get the transcript thrown out. I should at least do that.
I have done that for the record. Earl's from St. Louis. His dad was a business owner who owned the laundromat that washed uniforms for the Cardinals and the Browns, the Gas House Gang teams of Dizzy Dean. So Earl knew those guys, knew Dizzy Dean and Joe Medwick and the famous Cardinals. He was also raised in part by an uncle who was a bookie, who was kind of a tough guy and a gambler and a gangster. So that's where Earl's tough guy side came from. Earl was a great young player. He signed out of high school.
Was Yogi Berra involved in that way, in any way, in St. Louis?
Yeah, they played on the same Legion team. Not teammates. Yogi was older, but they were in the same Legion program, so they knew each other.
Well, I'm a travel log and I'm a foodie log and whatever. And when I went to St. Louis, Bernie Miklas, who I worked with 40 years ago here in Baltimore, you know, and the St. Louis people, I mean, Howard Balzer was out there at the time covering the Rams. They all sent me to great places. I mean, I've been to just Americana awesomeness, but the Little Italy area of St. Louis, it has a different name than Little Italy, I think.
The Hill,
thank you. Has all of these Italian restaurants, and everything about it is Yogi Berra. There's a baseball field in the middle of the neighborhood. If you ever go to St. Louis, and it's not like hard to access, but it's not like on the bus line or on the rail. You have to like drive into it. It's not downtown. It's a neighborhood. And
here's a fun fact. So Earl's mom was German, so she cooked German food. So that's what he grew up eating, sauerkraut and cabbage and such. And they also gardened. So his parents liked the garden. That's where he learned how to garden. And so he knew Yogi, but they were not part of the same clan. Like Yogi was Italian, Earl was German. Earl was more, down by the docks, kind of tough guy, street guy, whereas Yogi was more Italian, working class. I want to tell those stories and humanize him. And his uncle,
who else
Bud,
was from St. Louis? Were there other people involved in his childhood?
Joe Garagiola. A bunch of people went to his high school who played in the major leagues. Roy Sievers, people whose names are forgotten. But his high school was a really good baseball
school. I had all
those
baseball cards. And I've had Joe Garagiola and Joe 100 times.
Yeah, so Earl went to a really good baseball high school, which graduated a lot of pro baseball players. And he was going to be one of them. And that was his dream. And you know, it got crushed. And that's what set him on a path to being a manager. But also accounts for his kind of anger and bitterness, too, that he really deserved. I think he deserved to make the major leagues. He hit 300 in spring training and batted in the same lineup as Stan Musial, his childhood hero, and then got cut, you know, crushed him.
Yeah, well, John Miller's here doing a book. I always ask this because, Eisenberg, I've written a couple books myself. I know how difficult it is. I've done it very in an unorthodox way, running a radio station, doing my thing, not with like a publisher and deadlines and editors and all of those big league things that you would have. When does it end for you? I mean, at some point, don't be Tom Scholes making Boston 3. You know, don't make this 15 years. But there comes a point where I know from a book standpoint, I did mine on really tight deadlines because they were Super Bowl books that I wanted to get out by Father's Day. So I went Jack Nicholson up to the hotel and all work and no play makes, you know, Nestor a dull boy. I think when you have something like this, you want to make it as great as you can make it, but you don't want it released in 2028 either, right?
I agree. So I signed the contract in November after we talked. Very exciting with Simon and Schuster. It's a big publisher. The book is book is due end of this year. My editor is also Tom Brady's editor. Did Tom Brady's diet book. That's very exciting. So December 31st, I have
you get avocado ice cream out of this or anything? You get a little deal.
90,000 words due end of this year. Then we spend all of next year working on it. So I've been told spring 2025. That's what I've been told.
So I'm early on this. I'm early to the party is what you're telling me. Yeah, I do not even have your best stories yet on the radio as part of this whole thing, because like, I bet you're still going to unearth some stuff here. So you're in hardcore, find people, find stories.
Yeah.
What are you seeking that you don't know about Earl Weaver that you're looking for in the next conversation with the next, when you sit with Palmer? Palmer's going to tell you, Palmer can write his own book. I'm sure he could.
I mean, here's the thing that was weird is that they all made fun of him, but yet they respected his leadership. And I think that's really an important lesson about leadership that we all can learn from is, you know, they mocked this guy and would tease him and imitate his voice and mess with him. But at the end of the day, he also led them to glory and they all followed his lead because he had baseball in his heart so purely, I think, because he had done it since he was 4 years old. He had started dreaming of being a big league ball player when he was four and didn't stop for 50 years. And so why do these guys follow somebody they made fun of all the time? I think is a really big question I'm after.
Well, he was such a hero in Baltimore, right? And in my childhood, and he was the manager, the only, in the way that whenever Harbaugh leaves or Tomlin leaves Pittsburgh, where you are, people will be like, I don't even remember Cowher. I don't even remember Billick, you know, because it's starting to be like a long, long time. And that's, you know, I just mentioned a couple of football coaches, Belichick's and places like that. The NBA doesn't have anything like that. The NHL has nothing like that.
Popovich in the NBA is like that.
Popovich, fair enough. Fair enough. But I mean, there's no pedigree of that. Sure, and certainly in baseball, Socia hung around a while and some guys, Gerard, you know, some guys have hung around a little while. But this is, you know, what Earl did was an old world sort of thing to come in and win championships with two or three different eras of players.
Here's a stat for you. Between 68 and 82, when he was the manager, the Orioles employed one manager. Every other major league team employed 300 combined. They changed managers all the time. The Orioles, he was the only one who was never fired in the 70s. And that's the key to the greatness, too, is that he lost Frank Robinson. He lost these players. And somehow
he lost everybody. I mean, I lost everybody. I was a kid. What's Doug DeSensei's doing in the Angels hat? Where's Don Baylor? Hey, didn't we have Reggie here for 5 minutes? Holy hell! Where's Wayne Garland? You know what I mean? Guy that played well here in the 70s left because we were broke. So get used to Rutschman and get used to Gunnar Henderson and Manny Machado. I mean, all of that. The 90s and the amount of money and what the Orioles became, and I'm researching that because I don't know, John, if you know this or not, they don't have a lease. There's no lease for the team. I'm the only guy that's actually talking about that because WBAL doesn't employ journalists. Jason Lockenfor is now working for Masson. So, you know, there's not going to be any reporting on any of this. They don't have a lease here. Yeah. And I'm talking about that, but the baseball thing that's been laid here and the greatness of all of this and all the money the Angelos boys have made and every Palmeiro that came in here and every Aubrey Huff that took millions of dollars. Man, all of this was laid by Brooks and by Palmer and Frank and Boog and my cousin and like all that in 66.
Yeah.
But boy, Weaver's era and Weaver's leadership and Hoffberger's leadership as an owner and then EBW and that era is a case study because Baltimore couldn't afford the Orioles. They lost the Colts. Yeah. They lost every player other than Brooks and Palmer. And everybody was afraid Palmer was – I mean, it's amazing Palmer didn't go pitch for the Red Sox or the Yankees.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is amazing because we lost everybody else.
Let me answer my own question here about what made Earl so great. And you can make fun of the players made fun of him. And, you know, everybody can make fun of the smoking and the drinking and the cussing, you know. But he really, really cared. And I think that's what made him great is that he knew baseball and he cared and he kept on caring. And when he came back in 85, he came back for the money and his heart was not in it. And I think that is a lesson, too, that if your heart's not in it, you're not going to do well. And he didn't.
Well, for you in researching him and 90,000 words, which feels like a lot of words till you have 130,000, you have to start to edit it. Because I know about these things.
You do know,
at some point, you stop the research. Who else do you need to talk to besides Palmer? I mean,
as many as people will talk to me. Like, I was emailing with John Maroon last week, and hopefully talk to Cal soon. And you know, Eddie's not talked to me yet. A few others from that. I mean, Brooks is not doing great.
Has Don Stanhouse talked to you?
Yeah, I've talked to him. Yeah, he's fun. But you know, the Orioles years to me, it's not the key mystery. The key mystery is more the 30s, 40s, 50s, is who was Earl Weaver before he got to the Orioles. And going deeper in those years and the things we don't know about, you know, this uncle who was a gangster. I mean, the guy taught him analytics through gambling. I mean, I think that's fascinating. Like, that's how Earl Weaver learned math, was hanging out with his bookie uncle. And that story's never been told. I'm going to tell it. And
now it just is. You just told it.
I know, but well, not as.
Where'd you find that one? Is that well?
He says it in his own book, in his own memoir. He talks about his bookie uncle. And then if you do more research, you find out the guy was arrested for all kinds of nasty stuff. I mean, you know, I'm beating up a congressman, running the mayor's dice game. You know, he was a real hoodlum, this guy, in St. Louis in the 40s. And that's who father.
Earl,
you know,
Weaver's father. Gangster uncle.
Yeah. That's like a punk band, right? I'm the next punk band.
Well, you're certainly picking a good time to write a book about Oriole history or a key person in the Orioles. You know, as I said, all of this from where we are right now, if you trace it back, if there's no Earl, I don't know there's any of this. If there's no Brooks,
I love this.
No,
I love this. I love this story. And by the way, you know, I live in Pittsburgh, but I love the Orioles. And I grew up listening to John Miller in Belgium. And when I was in San Francisco, I was being 19 and wild. And I talked my way into the broadcast booth to meet the real John Miller, the other John Miller. I'm also the real John Miller.
Right.
To meet the other John Miller and just thank him for being my favorite broadcaster. And he signed my little journal when I was 19, keeping a journal. And I met him, and that was really fun. And I obviously love that guy.
Well, see, I've been on the radio 31 years. So I was in the middle of all of the contract. I was the guy taking phone calls when Peter fired him and threw him out and blamed it on his wife on my airwaves. Peter came on my airwaves and blamed John Miller's wife for him leaving Baltimore. John Miller sat in my studio and sobbed on the air over at the Sheraton in Towson when he came back on a book tour. He had written a book when he was with the Giants and they were playing Philadelphia because there were no Washingtons. And this is 1997. I mean, before I even had NST. This is in my old – I'm celebrating 25 years of having the radio station in 6 weeks, 5 weeks, and on August 3rd. We'll be at Dundalk, by the way. I want to plug that because I'm straight out of Dundalk. We're going to be in Costas on August 3rd celebrating 25 years. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery and our friends at Window Nation. We'll be there all day on the 3rd, and then on the 4th, we're going to be at Drug City celebrating. But part of the all the celebration, my last name's Aparicio. This goes back to baseball and football, really being sort of these root parts of our community. And Earl, you talk about him being a nephew of the gangster and all that stuff, but the baseball side of Earl, I don't think any of us ever thought of Earl Weaver playing baseball or even thought, was he a second baseman? What did he play? You know what I mean? It never occurred to me as a kid that Earl ever played baseball.
Yeah, I know, because he looks so funny. And you know, he ate and drank too much, and so he gained some weight and was not in playing shape. But you know, Tippi Martinez told me a story that he used to imitate or replace the base runner when they would do pickoff moves. And so he was on first base, and he says to Flanagan, aren't you going to try to pick me off? And Flanagan says, I can't see anybody. Is there somebody on first base? Because they were always making fun of how short he was.
Flanagan was a killer with the sense of humor, man. I mean, Flanagan would dice you up. There's no doubt about that. John Miller's here. He's writing a book on Earl Weaver. It's not due for a little while, but I'm having him tell me some stories anyway. So the heart of this thing, really, it's not an Oriole story, right, at all. Like, it's an Earl biography, and the Orioles are part of it, but you're way more interested in how he got there and how those 16 years are a hard 16 years, right?
I would say half the book is the Orioles. But I mean, I think if you're an Orioles fan, you're going to be fascinated because this is, I'm going to tell you where this guy came from, because he's such a weird person. Like, there's nobody else like him in American baseball, or even American history. I mean, don't forget, he was on the cover of Time magazine. He was the Playboy interview between Ansel Adams and Ted Turner. You know, that's how important he was to the culture. Like, he was a big deal in American culture in the 70s and 80s.
He did a Playboy interview.
Yes, he was.
What? 83. Who was on the cover?
My wife says, I feel like that magazine is in every room of the house.
1983?
Yeah, you can find it online. Yeah.
And yeah, what did he say? That's an interesting time in his life, right? Like, he had just walked away, ridden off on the car. Sutton beat Palmer. Yeah. We could have, you know, like the whole deal.
He was trying to become more of a TV personality. And it turns out he wasn't that good at it. And so ABC did not renew his contract after the 84 season. And that's one of the reasons he came back and managed, was it didn't work out in TV. But he was trying to increase his profile. And again, he was really famous, you know, even among people who are not baseball fans in the 70s and 80s. And that's kind of the point of my book, too, is the manager in baseball has lost that cultural relevance he used to have. And Earl had that. So what did he say? I mean, he talked about his life, and they asked him about, you know, religion, sex, those kinds of things that Playboy interviews are about. What's he up to now? Gardening.
Well, that's why I asked, because like, that's an interesting 1982. It's kind of edgy. I mean, Earl had the curly hair going then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was kind of like,
didn't
have to like work in baseball anymore. He was a celebrity. Yeah. He wasn't a manager anymore. He was a celebrity at that point. Right.
That's right. Yeah. Which is funny. So he got pretty deep though. I mean, I talked about, we talked a lot about how he was trying to enjoy life and not be a baseball person, and that kind of quest for his own identity. And he said, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life watching the sun go down behind the left field grandstand. Like, he wanted to have a life. And he was somebody who, you know, his dad wanted him to be a ball player, dressed him up as a ball player. And he was 4 years old, signed when he was 17 out of high school. You know, it's all he ever did or cared about. And all of a sudden he's 53. You know, who am I? What am I doing? And I think
he just played golf the rest of his life, smoked cigarettes, right? Like, literally, that's what he did the last 30 years, right?
He loved the ponies. He loved to gamble. He loved to, you know, talk a lot of crap, you know, make fun of people. You know, he was kind of a troll, honestly. I think he would be very at home and online Twitter.
Yeah, he came and visited with us at spring training a number of times when they trained in Fort Lauderdale. So this is late 90s. I have a lot of pictures of him sitting on our set later in his life. But when he did that, he was just sort of like, it wasn't anything in depth, to your point. Like, it's nothing I would offer to you to say, this would be good stuff for your book. He's sitting there talking to me and Bob Haney about, you know, whether Eric, some pitcher is going to make it or not. None of them made it.
Tom Boswell told me Earl had a shell and he used that shell to protect himself. But when he revealed himself beneath the shell, which I think you got to in that last interview, people were floored because he was so insightful. He had thought so much about himself and life and baseball. And he had these like incredibly deep ways of looking at the world. Like, he was, Tom Boswell told me his favorite saying was, everything changes everything, which actually is like one of the most profound quotes in like Roman Greek philosophy is everything changes, you know. So he had this kind of like very wise way of understanding the world and how complex it is and how you have to accept uncertainty. And so I love that side of him, that he had this depth to him that was, you know, hidden beneath all the temper tantrums and the drinking and the smoking.
Well, I hope you find that depth in him over the next 6 months. I know you're how obsessed are you with this? Have you pissed off everybody in your family? And I mean, I see the beards coming in now. I mean, are you getting to the Torrance phase of this thing here?
Earl grew a mustache once in the 70s, and it was not a good fit.
I've never seen a picture of that.
I have a picture. I can send it to you. And Kim Benson and his daughter, stepdaughter, when I sent it to her, she was like, oh, we all try to forget that time.
You know what I want to see? I want to see, it's very famous to see the picture of the 420 game winners, you know, Cuellar, McNally, those guys in the orange, the pumpkin outfits in 71. Yeah. Remember that? They wore them a couple years ago here. They threw them up to throw them out, to throw them back. It made me throw up. but they're so ugly, they're beautiful. But a picture of Earl in that gear, I've never, that would look interesting, yeah, right?
I think I have that. I also have a picture of Earl as a toddler, which is pretty.
I think I've seen that. He was really cute, right?
Yes. Yeah,
I think I've seen the toddler picture. I really do.
Yeah.
Because it
yeah,
looks
yeah.
like him. It looks like Spanky.
He's got a little bat. Yeah.
Well, he was of that era too, right? The R Gang era. He was like of that age, right?
Born in 1930. Yep. And he, you know, he was kind of preppy in his high school, but also, you know, he had a foul mouth, and he had a foul mouth when he was a teenager. And
always.
He was famous for teaching the other kids, you know, terrible words.
Well, I mean, poor Alice in Norfolk. I mean, she's still trying to get over, you know, that pinprick. John Miller is here, the other John Miller with the H. He is an author and a journalist and a longtime writer at the Wall Street Journal. He's recovering and working on a Earl Weaver biopic. I check in with him every 6 months. So I owe you a call right around Christmas time. Try to check
Sounds
in.
Good.
We'll see where the Ravens and see if Lamar's upright and they're 12-2 at the time, like we all think they're going to be. And the Steelers, they stink, and the Bengals are like, hey man, I gotta talk to Smack here in the summertime with the Ravens. But the Orioles thing, I was gonna say to you, and I meandered off topic earlier, but the Orioles resurgence at this time, you know, an interesting time for you to be writing about this, because Brandon Hyde is about to transcend and survive this, right? He has survived this, right? Like, he survived all the awful. He's here. They're gonna be good for a couple of minutes at least for the time being. This is an interesting time for you to write about this, because baseball is starting to pick itself back up a little bit here.
And I can't hide that I love the Orioles. And, you know, Brandon Hyde will be the second longest tenured manager soon after Buck. It's Earl Buck, and then it's going to be Brandon Hyde.
That's an interesting observation, right? That's wild.
Yeah, no, it's obviously terrific, all the young talent, and I'm really enjoying the season. The Orioles have been a bit recalcitrant about talking about Earl. I don't think they sort of worship him like I do. I think they're worried about him being kind of like the embarrassing old uncle. So I've not talked to any current Orioles about Earl Weaver.
Well, they won't know who he is. I mean, no offense, but like,
he's got a statue. He's got a statue. Well, I'm going to tell him who he is. So there you go.
Yeah. All right. Straight out of Dundalk. That was the way I would say it if I were you. John Miller's here. He is an author and writer. I'm going to let you get back to doing whatever you do, going up to that crazy fun park they have in Pittsburgh and all the stuff that they do up there in summertime. I'll get up there for a concert before it's all over. Good luck with the book. And I love checking in with you. And and you started the whole thing. You found that crazy, wacky video of me with Earl at the end.
Yeah.
I wish I would have done more now, right? Like, Earl gave me 15 minutes, and then 45 minutes into it, he's talking and I can't stop him.
Well, I think, and I'll explain this in my book, but like, I think when I explain the context of what he was saying, you'll understand how deep your interview was.
Wow. Now I got to get your book.
Yeah.
John Miller is here. We appreciate the time as always. I appreciate great baseball conversations. We're having them all summer long around here. I'm going to be doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour on Thursday. We're going to be at Fadley's. If John, when you come to Baltimore, I owe you a crab cake at the very, very least. So we'll take you around to maybe some of Earl Weaver's. I bet he was a Polack Johnny's guy, Earl Weaver.
But
we're going to be out this week at Fadley's in the morning on Thursday. Got some great guests lined up. Really looking forward to talking 4th of July. Crabs. I got my Leonard Raskin, a Raskin Global, but it has the beer opener. So I'm going to have this with me on August the 3rd at Costas as we celebrate 25 years. Big thanks to our friends at Window Nation also for sponsoring the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. Fadley's this week and lots of dates and places into July and into August. 25 oysters coming soon, too, for our 25th anniversary. I am Nestor. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. The legend of Earl Weaver. I love these conversations. We never stop talking.
Are we off the air here?
Not yet. No. Baltimore Positive. Now we're off the air.